Okay, so it took me like 2 months, but I finally finished my mister. So, two down, only like 300 more to go on your mom's handy dandy list of all of the K-dramas we have to catch up on.
Wait, would you be willing to watch My Mister again with me?
No,
Oh
because every episode is like 1 hour and 15 minutes
my
plus.
gosh. Yeah, there's so many. Ever since we started watching, we watched Kingdomland together, and then you were watching My
I
Mister.
mean, our entire algorithm is already just Korean shows at this point, so.
Oh, do you want to watch Crash Landing on You next? That's on my mom's list.
How many years is every episode?
I don't know.
There's so much Korean stuff on Netflix. How will we ever get through it?
Yeah, well, better start getting through more of it because Netflix announced they're purchasing $2.5 billion more worth of Korean dramas.
There are not enough hours in life.
I mean, maybe there are enough hours in life because people can't seem to get enough of it. Korean TV shows are at the top of Netflix most watched lists. Korean cinema is winning awards, winning Academy Awards. Even on the music side, it's getting more Korean. BTS is having a bunch of number one hits on Billboard in the US. It got me wondering, why does it seem like Korean pop culture is just everywhere right now? So for this episode, we're gonna dive deep into that question. Hello, this is Culture Jumpers, stories about making the jump from one cultural context to another. I'm Lino Nicolaou.
And I'm Alana Whites.
Today on the show, the global phenomenon known as Hallyu, the Korean Wave.
I'm Rosalie Kim, and I work as a curator for Korean art and design at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
We wanted to talk to Rosalie because she was recently the lead curator for an exhibit for the V&A in London, dedicated to this recent explosion in Korean pop culture. And this was actually an unexpected role for her. Though she was born to Korean parents, Rosalie mostly grew up in Belgium and France. And other than a short stint living in Korea and a few trips here and there as a child, she didn't have much exposure to Korean pop culture growing up. And so, what was your first experience that you had with popular Korean media that stands out in your memory?
I think it was actually Satyeji and the Boys, which is considered as the first K-pop band as we know or understand them today. And they started their career in 1992. I remember when my aunt stayed with us in Belgium, she said that, oh, they are the biggest band in Korea. And well, to my taste, I feel like it's quite noisy, but you youngsters might like it. And I thought, how much of that can it be exciting from Korea? And I remember going to the living room with my brother, putting that on the CD player, and we're just blown away by the sound. It was so fresh, so different to all these melancholic songs and cheesy songs that you had at the time. And I thought for the first time that Korea was cool. Korea was, at the time when I was growing up in Belgium, considered as, a third world country. Nobody had heard of that. And all of a sudden, I felt like, ooh, Korea is cool.
Okay, I'm gonna pause this real quick because I'm really curious what this sounds like now. So I'm gonna play a short clip of it. I've got it queued up right here.
His best Flavor Flav impression? What? It's like Korean Marky Mark.
No, I mean, this is New Jack Swing. This is, the prominent R&B hip hop.
What the heck? What is that? Metal got some Megadeth going on? Like, that just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, but it actually still kind of works. I've never heard anyone mix New Jack Swing with metal like that.
I mean, I guess in like mid-90s you had Rage Against the Machine,
Yeah,
but
that's
that's
true.
not really the same. You have like Korn starting out, but it's still not, it doesn't have that pop flavor.
Right, because even Rage, it was rap, but it was over all rock instrumentation. And then,
Like, you're not gonna have Rage playing like in a nightclub with like teens dancing to it.
right.
I mean, I feel like the closest things maybe you get. So you have Beastie Boys who are
Right.
mixing like the rock and the rap.
Yeah.
But it's...
You gotta fight for your right to party.
That's the only Beastie Boys song that you know, isn't it?
No, but that's like the most rock version in the show. But they don't have the singing.
And it's missing like that New Jack Swing thing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Michael Jackson kind of has that. Like, that time he was hanging out with like Slash and Van Halen. You got like Black or White.
But he's not rapping, though. That's...
Yeah, it's like all of these bands, like you have two or three of the elements, but I don't think there's anything in America at this time that puts all of these things together. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Like, if the listeners want to chime in and tell us that our music history knowledge is terrible, feel free, but I can't think of anything.
Yeah, so like for 1992, this must have sounded pretty groundbreaking. Rosalie keeps alluding to this notion that Korea was considered a third world country, and it's so hard to imagine that, knowing what Korea looks like today. But she wasn't exaggerating. Only a few decades ago, Korea didn't look anything like the country that could have produced the kind of music that Seseji and Boys did. For a lot of the 20th century, Korean art and culture was heavily influenced by other countries. In 1910, Japan colonized Korea and became a major foreign influence. This would last until the Japanese Empire dissolved at the end of World War II.
At the end of the Second World War, Korea falls under the effect of the Cold War in the West, which means that the peninsula is divided arbitrarily along the 38th parallel, with the northern side placed under the trusteeship of the Soviet Union and the south under that of the Americans. The Korean War happens in 1950, when North Korea, with the support of China, invades South Korea in the hope to reunify the country under the communist banner. And this will trigger the Korean War that will last for 3 years. And the war ends with an armistice, which means that they are still technically at war.
During the Korean War, the US military set up multiple bases around South Korea. And America still had a very large presence, even in the years after the armistice.
And in this context, pop culture gets into Korea mainly through the American military bases and their broadcasting companies and systems. And so those bases are organizing music performances with guests like Marilyn Monroe. The diamonds are at your best friend. And she was actually wearing a spaghetti strap dress by minus 30 degrees in the countryside of Korea to perform in front of a massive amount of soldiers wearing their winter jackets, which was quite a sight.
Besides Marilyn Monroe, Western rock music had a huge impact on the Korean rock scene in the 60s. During this period, psychedelic rock was spreading from the West to Korea. And one of the main pioneers of the genre in Korea was a rock guitarist named Shin Jung-hyun. He hit mainstream success, producing songs for a duo called the Pearl Sisters. Like this song from 1968, and it's one of their more famous ones called A Cup of Coffee. And then here he is in 1970 performing a live cover of a very famous American song by Iron Butterfly. And I'm really embarrassed to say, the main reason Ilana and I know this song is because of the Simpsons episode where Bart cons his church into singing it as a hymn.
Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
But while some Koreans were freeing their minds through psychedelic rock music, the government was about to get way more strict.
So at the end of the Korean War, South Korea is poorer than North Korea. It has a GDP that is lower than that of Haiti, Ethiopia, 40% lower than that of India. So in short, it's considered as a third world country, really. In 1961, there is a coup d'etat and General Park Chung-hee is taking over the control of South Korea. And from his side, I suppose that the popular culture is not meant to entertain, but actually to educate, to form, and to shape people's mind. And in this context, Park Chung-hee's military rule tries to define a new Korean identity that is rooted in its cultural tradition, in its history, free from colonial influences.
Right. It's a little bit more nationalist.
Yeah, they had more nationalistic, patriotic sort of connotations. But for them, it was also a risk in terms of rebellion against their authority because these Western sort of cultural contents were too liberal for their eyes.
From that point on, the government tried to get people to listen to music that sounded more like this. It's called The Song of the Year of Working, and it's a lot less Jimi Hendrix and a lot more Borat's version of the Kazakhstan national anthem. And it's really jarring to hear this kind of thing coming from South Korea, because this is what I would expect from North Korea. But during this time, South Korea was also a dictatorship, and its leader, Park Chung-hee, did very dictator-like things. For example, he declared martial law, then he got rid of term limits for himself. In 1972, he asked Shin Jung-hyun, the Korean rock legend we were talking about earlier, to compose a song singing his praises. Shin Jung-hyun refused, and instead he wrote a song that had nothing to do with Park. In retaliation, Park Chung-hee threw him in jail, although the official story was that he was arrested for, of all things, weed possession. So yeah, Park Chung-hee checked a lot of the dictator boxes. But at the same time, you might find that a lot of Koreans, especially older Koreans, actually have a very positive opinion of him. Under his regime, South Koreans experienced dramatic increases in their standard of living, partly because he heavily invested in infrastructure. For example, he made this big bet on a highway running all the way from Seoul in the northwest of the country to Busan in the southeast. Today, it's the busiest highway in Korea. And Park Chung-hee made sure the countryside didn't get left behind either. His infrastructure plan included modernizing roofs of rural homes and hooking them up with electricity and running water.
So it is during that time in the 1960s and 70s that the economic recovery starts to take place. Koreans are now in a better financial position, so they start to buy radios and TVs. And TVs, by the sort of mid-1960s, early 1970s, becomes the main source of entertainment for Koreans. And so when the military rule ends in 1987, Korea is propelled onto the international scene for the first time as a young democracy with a sound economy. And that moment will be the Seoul Olympic Games of 1988. And from that moment onwards, you have a gradual lifting of military censorships regarding cultural and creative productions. And therefore, you have a better and diverse storyline for films, TV dramas, and also for music as well, and which is sort of a prequel to the explosion of Korean pop culture in the 1990s.
And this is the point at which you had your first experience, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Which brings us back to Satsuji and Boys. You know, these guys.
Yeah, boy!
And their 1992 debut on TV.
They started their career on TV, on a reality TV show, a bit X Factor style. It was a program where various singers or groups would come dressed in evening gowns, you know, singing ballads under the spotlight, behind a static microphone. And amidst this kind of sea of gentle ballads and trap music, you had this band of three boys coming up dressed in street style.
자, 그러면 서태지 씨와 그 친구들의 난 알아요 박수로 청해 듣겠습니다.
And they were dancing all over the stage, and you see the camera having a hard time following them on stage. And they scored the lowest results of the evening. And they were told they had no future in music. And they were proved wrong because Satyajit and Boys went on to become the biggest band at the time in Korea. And they completely changed the way music was produced, the type of content you had, because even the lyrics were very much socially engaged and especially appealing to the younger generation. And so they really became the emblem of Korean cool sort of thing in the 1990s.
Throughout the rest of the 90s, Korean creatives gained more and more freedom, The economy kept growing, growing, growing. But then everything almost derailed.
In 1997, you have the Asian financial crisis that hit Korea. And it is really a moment of national sort of humiliation because they have a historic bailout from the International Monetary Fund taking place at that moment. And the chaebols, which are the large familial conglomerates and the heavy industries, were very much impacted and they had to reassess their economy.
So Korea finds itself in this do or die moment and the government goes for a very counterintuitive move. Well, at least it's counterintuitive to me, who's used to American politics. Instead of austerity measures and budget cuts to the arts, the government actually doubles down on its investment in the arts, specifically entertainment. And that's partially because of a 1994 report about the movie Jurassic Park.
So the case of the Jurassic Park is the fact that the sales of the tickets made from Jurassic Park outperformed the sale of 1.5 million Hyundai cars. It takes less infrastructure and monies to make a movie than to make a car because we don't have the raw resources in Korea. We have to import them to make the cars. So they are quite costly. And so the math is quickly done for the Korean government. And so they start to see this as a viable export industries and they start to put monies towards it and to support the cultural industries.
And that marked the official beginning of Hallyu, the Korean wave, where, along with tech and industry, the Korean government would invest heavily in the creation and export of its popular culture. The theory was that it was not only a good financial investment, but it was also a way for Korea to form relationships with other countries, opening the door for bigger opportunities in the future.
At the same time, Korea started to roll out high-speed internet technology in the mid-1990s. And you had lots of what we call the PC Bang and Tanja Cafes, which are basically the sort of template for gaming centers as well as cyber cafes or internet cafes later across the world. And so at the time when the country was facing their major financial crisis, they invested into ICT and into entertainment industries. And so in hindsight, that was a huge gamble to take at the time, but it sort of paid off now.
Do you think that Hallyu happens if there wasn't also that simultaneous investment in the tech side of things? Or do you think that both of them needed to happen in order for Hallyu to be created?
I think this happened because there were different factors. And one of the factors is the role of the state. And the other factor is the quick embrace of the digital sort of revolution, if you'd like. That was actually partially motivated by the fact that the country thought that they were colonized in the early 20th century because they were too slow at embracing the industrial revolution and modernization process. So when the next thing happened, they wanted to be at the forefront rather than in the trailing back. So you had that on the other side. And then you had the fact that it was a colonized country across its history. So a lot of Asian countries who also experienced the colonization can see Korea as a sort of aspiration, something that they could relate to. And then you also have the key audience, which is your millennial and Gen Z audience, which are much more culturally diverse. So I think all of that helped Hallyu to come to the fore.
It's interesting that you mentioned the fact that Korea had a history of colonization meant that they could be looked up to by other countries. Do you also think the fact that Korea didn't have a history of colonizing others made it easier for Korean culture to be exported?
I think so. Absolutely. That's a good point to make as well. They didn't really went on to colonize or had ambitions to colonize other parts of the regions. And I think that certainly play a role in some areas. Yes.
Because I'm also trying to think, why has Korea had so much more, at least recent success, in exporting its culture compared to, say, China and Japan? Obviously, China and Japan are still exporting their culture, but it seems like Korea is doing it in a much bigger way, at least recently.
I think Japan had its moment in the 1990s, but the issue with Japan is that they never really meant to export their culture. They have a really strong domestic market. So they produce content for local consumption. So J-pop was not really something that you would export in the same way Korea did, for example. And actually, Japan is the second biggest music market after the US. So for Koreans, Japan was an important, albeit kind of a difficult neighbor due to their histories. But I think understanding the economy meant that they had to make amends and they had to start engaging with Japan and tapping into the huge Japanese market. And also, I think Korea was much more inclined to use the internet to distribute their cultural content. So, for example, K-pop is launching their K-pop songs on YouTube rather than just going through their record companies. And so I think these kind of aspects has influenced the fact that maybe Korea became a bit bigger now compared to Japan in the 1990s.
Starting at the beginning of the 21st century, the Korean wave really took off. I'm just going to go really quickly through some milestones over the next two decades. This is by no means an exhaustive list, but here we go. The film Old Boy by Park Chan-wook debuted in 2004. It would later inspire Spike Lee to do a remake, although it is not better than the original. One of the most famous K-pop girl groups in history, Girls' Generation, formed in 2007. One of the members, Yuna, is a lead character in the K-drama we mentioned at the top of the show, King Dilan. Though Hallyu took over a lot of Korea's neighboring Asian countries in the aughts, most Americans weren't really quite aware of it until 2012 when this song came out. In 2013, the movie Snowpiercer by director Bong Joon-ho was released in the United States, starring Chris Evans, aka Captain America. If you don't recognize that movie, then maybe you recognize one of Bong's other two movies, which were Okja, the Netflix original in 2017, and Parasite, which won the Oscar for Best Picture. In 2017, the Bangtan Boys make their US debut at the American Music Awards. You might know them better by their acronym. And then, also in 2017, Rosalie Kim got the idea for an exhibit at the Victoria and Albert Museum that would focus specifically on Hallyu, an idea that was finally realized in 2022.
So the exhibition is really celebrating and delving into the cultural phenomenon that is Hallyu, which is the Korean wave, the meteoric rise of pop culture from South Korea that took the world by storm in the past few decades. So in order to tell the story, we have divided the exhibition into five sections, starting with Psy and his Gangnam Style, not because he's the first K-pop star, but because his music video went viral back in 2012, breaking the YouTube play counter 2 years later, but firmly putting South Korea on the global map of pop culture. So we are showing the suit that Psy wore together with the music video and sort of myriads of cover versions of it to showcase the global scale of this. And then we use an image of Gangnam, which is basically a district located south of the River Han in Seoul, and which is considered as the most affluent part of Korea today. And we show an image of Gangnam with its glitzy skyscrapers, fancy boutiques, and contrasted with a black and white picture of the same Gangnam just 30 years, 40 years prior, when it was an empty rice paddy field with concrete apartment blocks dotting the banks of the River Han. So we create this visual shock to go into the second section, which is a dive into the compressed modern history of Korea.
After that, the exhibit had a section dedicated to Korean television and cinema, where they had a recreation of the famous bathroom scene from the movie Parasite. Then another section for K-pop, which covered not just the pop artists, but also their very passionate fan bases. And then lastly, a section on Korean beauty and fashion. What have people's reactions been?
The reactions were really good, so we were really happy about it because we had so much trouble to make this exhibition during COVID time where we were not allowed to travel, where quarantine was in place. So it was nice to see people's reaction and they were just like, oh, now it makes sense. Oh, I can see that now and I can recognize this. And the older generation find it really interesting because they learn about the historical side and they can now relate to the interests of their grandchild and children. And the children came and they had fun time because the exhibition is quite interactive in many ways. And many of the younger generations can recognize the songs or the films or the TV dramas, and they can share now that kind of interest with their parents. So we didn't really intend to have a family audience, but we ended up with a lot of families.
One section in particular was a massive hit with museum visitors.
We also had worked with Google Arts and Culture in order to create a dance interactive where we invite the visitors to become a K-pop idol for a day.
That's great. What was people's reactions to becoming a K-pop star?
Oh my God, that people were queuing for that and they were screaming while dancing because you had a section where you can actually dance, record yourself, and then the image of yourself was projected onto the wall as part of a music video together with other people who had performed different dances before you. So it was quite a fun interactive moment.
So why do you think now was the right time to do this exhibit? Hallyu has been going on for decades, as we've established, but do you feel like we've crossed some kind of milestone that you feel like now is the right time to do it?
Well, this is quite a funny question because the exhibition took place now, but I pitched for the idea to the museum in 2019. Nobody heard of the term Hallyu in the museum, and not many people knew about K-pop or K-drama. Then the pandemic and lockdown hit the rest of the world, and I thought, that's it. Nobody's going to be interested in doing an exhibition on Korean pop culture. But actually, that was a time where BTS exploded. Then, you know, Netflix came to the fore with all these amazing selections of K-dramas. Then Parasite exploded. And by the time I came back to work and continued pitching and make a business case for the exhibition, everybody was saying like, yes, we have to do this and you have to do this earlier than what you have pitched for. And so by the time we started preparing the exhibition, Squid Game exploded. It was really timely that we did the exhibition. People think that we've done that just because this is becoming popular, but it's impossible for a museum like ours, which has 170 years of history. It's like a dinosaur to move. You can't move that fast. And so this has been in the making for a couple of years now. And so we are really lucky that things exploded at the right time for us.
Right, right. And I'm curious, how does it make you feel as part of the Korean diaspora?
Yeah. When I was growing up in the 1980s in Europe, Korea, nobody had heard of. Many people thought I was an adoptee. People would just come to me saying hi in Chinese or Japanese. And when you had your lunch with your kimbap and kimchi, people would say, oh my God, they had funny reactions about this. It's a cliche sort of thing, right? But now people consider Korean food as a staple of healthy food, you know, like kimchi is like fermentation, probiotics, all the things good for you. People know where South Korea is. They actually travel there for leisure purposes rather than businesses only. And people start to get interested in Korean language as well. And so for me, it's incredible to see how quickly Korea has managed to change completely their image from a third world country to a global trendsetter. And now there is a sense of almost a pride as well to talk about Korean culture. I think the most surprised person must be my mom, because growing up, I was so rebelling against my Korean cultural heritage. I felt like Korea was really at the bottom of the pile, and she kept on telling me, go to the mirror, go look yourself, you're not Belgian, and look at where I am. I'm now one of the biggest spokesperson in the museum about Korean culture.
Yeah. I'm wondering if the younger you could see this exhibit and you as an adult, like, what would she think?
Well, when my parents tried to ingrain Korean history into my brain, I had this kind of special skill at automatically shutting down. And I think this exhibition would have been quite nice for a younger self to understand what my parents were trying to do and have a better understanding of my own cultural heritage at the time. So I think that would be the biggest change for me, I think, as a young person.
Today's episode of Culture Jumpers was hosted and produced by Alana Weitz and me, Lionel Nicolau. It was also written and edited by me. Music by Alana Weitz. Special thanks to my mom, who got us hooked on the Korean dramas that started this whole journey, and Dr. Rosalie Kim for taking the time to sit down with us to talk about the Korean wave. If you want to get a chance to see the Hallyu exhibit, it's currently on display at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston from March 24th until July 28, 2024. If you liked today's episode,
please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps the show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. And even on the music side, you have BTS and Blackpink. They're just climbing the charts on Billboard. It just seems
you're
like...
You're not going to mention your favorites?
Oh, yes. Yes.
How could you do blue jeans like that?
Blue jeans? No. New jeans.
Whatever.
New
jeans. My bad.